Blog Talk Radio. Welcome to Peach State Pandemonium, a production brought to you by GeorgiaWrestlingHistory.com. Take a trip down memory lane for a look at professional wrestling the way it used to be. Return with us now to those thrilling days of yesteryear as PSP rides again. And now, the GWH Radio Network presents Peach State Pandemonium with your hosts, Mike Norris, Jerry Oates, and Bobby Simmons.
Good evening, everybody, and welcome to Peach State Pandemonium. This is Michael Norris, and today is the last day of March. Welcome to this edition of Peach State Pandemonium. And I am joined, as always, by my co-host, Jumping Jerry Oates, and Bobby the Mover Simmons.
He got both of those wrong, I'm telling you. On my end, anyhow. Are you all done,
Bobby? Did
you turn
the keys over for the old building today, Bobby?
Yeah, I did a walkthrough on the old building today, and we were, today was the most peaceful day I've had in over a week, so yeah, we're pretty close, so I'm actually off tomorrow and Monday, and I told them, I said, if the building burns down over the weekend, I'll find out about it Tuesday, don't call me.
Well, I got a question for you. I thought this the other day after I talked to you. Why do they need keys to that building if they're just going to tear it down? Are they afraid somebody's going to steal something out of it?
Listen, why did they have me pay somebody to sweep it out if they're just going to tear it down? The park engineer met us over there. I met the assistant manager from the office park and the head engineer, and the engineer said, I don't know why we're walking through. He said, we're not going to do nothing but tear it down. So, I don't know.
How far did you move from where you are?
Jerry, we moved about 6 miles as a crow flies, but we moved from north, a little bit north of downtown, into downtown. And it is absolutely, I've never had to pay to park in my life to work. But this place where we moved into, this office building, has a parking deck, and they leased the parking deck to a parking company, and my company agreed to pay parking for, there's about 60 employees. They agreed to pay parking for a year, and I'm the one that actually pays the bills for the facility, for that part of the facility. It's costing us $35,000 to park 60 cars for a year.
Can we get us a lot?
I'm in the wrong business.
It's like
the old joke where the plumber comes out and works on the lady's house and gets through working and tells the lady, he works for about 20 minutes and tells the lady, so it'd be $150. And she says, my goodness. She says, I'm a doctor and I don't make that kind of money. And the plumber said, well, when I was a doctor, I didn't make that kind of money either.
So, there you go. That's a good one.
Well, having been in the parking business in a way, that's not a fun business to be in. When I, the assistant operations manager of the downtown Macy's, they had their own parking facility right across Ella Street there. And that was one of my responsibilities that fell under my jurisdiction. I replaced more parking gates in a year. I bet I spent $5,000-$6,000 on those little arms. Because people would get impatient, or they didn't have the money, or they thought they could beat it, or whatever, and they would run through there and knock that gate off.
I don't doubt that at all, brother. I don't doubt that at all.
Well, this parking deck where I'm at, we're only a block north of the Fox. So they've got all these people that work. It's an 11-story office building. You got all these people that work in this building that park there during the day. And then at night, they sell parking to the Fox, and they charge $12 a car. And I don't know how many this place holds, but if you put 100 cars a night in there at $12 a car, that's $1,200 a night. And that's gravy.
Yep.
There's evidently a fortune in it.
Well, in my luck, I'd buy a parking deck. Nobody would ever park there. But
that's
know,
right.
That's just... But it seems very lucrative to me.
I had to actually have an overnight person there, even though the Macy's store downtown at that when I worked, it closed at 6 o'clock. there were other things around downtown, our store was in walking distance of some restaurants, and actually even the Omni, when the Omni existed, was if you wanted to make that walk, it was, you know, a 6 or 8 block walk, but you could do it. And I had to staff it there. I had to keep one person there overnight, so I had to run a third shift just for that. Nothing to do with the store business, but that was, we made a lot of money. Especially when we started, a lot of people, I had monthly parkers. I had people who paid me monthly to park there. And we charged everybody at the store level, below the level of senior executive. I charged them either daily or monthly. They had their own little swipe card and everything else. Of course, I didn't pay. I never did figure out how that worked, but now I never had to pay. But I figured.
I wonder why.
Yeah.
If you did me a favor or something, you'd have to pay either, at least for.
That's the way it works. Bobby, when you go see the Falcons play, what's the parking situation there? Do they have enough?
I always ride MARTA. I park at a station. It doesn't cost anything to park at the MARTA station, and it's like $2 each way on MARTA, so you spend $4 to ride it down there. But it lets you out, 150 yards from the dome, and you just walk in, go through the gate, and turn around, come back out. But they have parking down there.
Is there enough parking? They charge you to park there too, I guess.
Oh yeah, it's just. Season parking pass. They offer me a season parking pass if I want it, and they run, depending on what lot you get in, they can run anywhere from $150 a year to $400 a year for 10 games, just depending on how close you want to be.
Well, I heard something while I was up there last week. Are they actually seriously talking about tearing the dome down and moving the Falcons to...
No, they're not going to tear the dome down. They're going to. The Falcons want a new stadium. Where they can get a better deal on the concessions and the parking and so forth, because the Georgia World Congress Center makes the majority of the money on the dome, but the dome would still be there, and it would still be used for different events. But the World Congress Center could use it for exhibition space and things like that. But yeah, they're talking about building a new open air stadium about 4 blocks north of where the dome's sitting now.
Well, for some reason I was thinking it was either in Gwinnett or I'd even heard something about the old GM or Ford plant or whatever that is out there in Doraville.
That fell through.
Up and doing something there.
Yeah.
Did it?
DeKalb County wouldn't give them the tax breaks they wanted. And if they move, I don't know, City of Atlanta is going to buck everything they try to do to get it outside the city limits of Atlanta. So, I don't know. For my part, they could play it at the old stadium. It didn't matter to me.
I don't know why
they build one in Jackson. They make it the Jackson Falcon and make it easier for you to go to the games. There's a lot of room out there in Henry County. They can probably build one out there somewhere.
Well, I tell you what, I like those open air domes football myself.
Yeah, I like it. I mean, it's absolutely insane to have a dome stadium in the city of Atlanta. One game a year, we might get wet. One game a year, we might get cold. But the majority of the time, you know, it's 70 degrees.
But does that dome stay busy?
I don't think it stays busy enough to justify it. You know, they have... in the winter, it stays a lot busier. Now they get the mega events in there, like they get every once in a while they get the NCAA Final Four basketball games there, or if a big concert comes in, they'll use the dome. Like the Rolling Stones have been there, and U2 has been there, and Paul McCartney played there one time. But you know, there's very few groups out there that you could put, you know, in a 72,000 seat venue.
Right.
But believe it or not, they're going to draw that for a wrestling match or for some sports entertainment Sunday. But that's, you know, it's just a every once in a while they have something they can use it for, like that, other than football. But the Falcons play 10 games a year there. Georgia State University plays their home games there. They just started a football program, and they play their home games there, but they only use the bottom tier of the dome. They don't even open the top two decks up. They play the Southeastern Conference Championship game there, and then, of course, the Peach Bowl. So
that's a lot of building for
yes, it is.
Events, in my opinion. But anyhow, what do I know?
Yeah, and people don't. I mean, you know, people that have never been on the other side of that coin, they have no clue what it takes, dollar wise, to open up and run or lease a facility of, you know, of that size. I mean, I never did anything of that nature, but I mean, just with the Omni, on a $100,000 house at the Omni, it costs you right at $28,000 just for rent and security and ushers, and I mean, you pay for everything.
There's no doubt. I checked on that new building in Columbus to rent it. Now, this is in Columbus, Georgia. To open the door, I mean, you had to have an ambulance. You had to have, I forgot how many policemen, guarantee them $18 an hour for minimum 3 hours. Ticket taker, ticket sellers. Ticket master got, I think it was a quarter a ticket. So, you know, to have a $10 ticket average, you got to go up to $12, $13 to get back to $13 average. And it was like 10 grand in Columbus just opened the door. Then there's a percentage that rolls into effect. You know what I'm saying? A little man can't rent a building anymore.
Georgia Championship Wrestling got a break because we ran the Omni so much. But I'm thinking in the 70s, when I became office manager and actually started where I could see some of this stuff, if I'm not mistaken, the rent for the Omni for Georgia Championship Wrestling was 18%. And it was a flat rate against 18%, whichever was greater. And if you drew, you know, we didn't sell it out every time we ran it. But we would, you know, we averaged, you know, we would do a $65,000, $70,000 house, which is still a lot of money. But you know, any time you got over about the $40,000 mark, then the 18% kicked in. And that 18% was just the base rent. That was not including, I forget what the ushers got. They got $10 an hour or something. The policemen, we had to pay the Omni security, and then we had our own police force. I mean, our own, we had about 20 policemen that we paid every week. They worked the auditorium for us, and we took them to the Omni with us. Because these were the guys that ushered, that walked the guys back and forth to the ring. These were guys that we paid to sit with their backs to the ring and watch the crowd. They didn't watch the matches. So, you know, what we did with them, we paid them $35 a night, but we paid their Social Security. So it wound up costing us about $50 a man.
It adds up, man.
Yes, sir. Yes, sir.
Insurance and all that on top.
Oh yeah, insurance and there was Jerry was talking an ambulance. You had to have paramedics on duty. I mean, it's people don't you know, these people that run these shows that don't do these things. I mean, they just say we're going to rent a high school gym, we're going to run a show. They have no clue. They have no clue what liability they open themselves up to.
Some you can never outrun.
It just takes one person tripping that's looking to make a buck. They'll sue everybody and their brother. They may not win. The expense is not in winning or losing a lawsuit. The expense is defending yourself.
Exactly. You lose either way.
Yes, sir. You can't win.
You're a loser.
We had boxes and boxes of records at Georgia Championship Wrestling. We had a closet that was slapped full of nothing but old box office records. I mean, towns that had run 20 years ago. But the law says as long as you're in any sort of litigation, you cannot destroy any records. You have to keep everything. And our attorney, the guy's name was Tench Cox, and he worked with the the law firm that Governor Sanders was with, and he told us, he said, the day that we have a day where, if any day ever comes up where we do not have a lawsuit, he said, we're going to have the biggest fire that y'all have ever seen to get rid of those records. But as long as I was there, that day never came.
It's a risky business, man.
Yes, it is.
There's a lot more to it than just putting on trunks and boots and going down and getting in a ring.
It's
a lot more to it.
And how guys go out here and do it today, you know, I guess they get guys to wrestle for $5 and $10, I guess. I don't know.
Oh, yeah.
I just don't know.
For free. A lot of guys,
well,
I
didn't want to go that far.
A lot of guys do. Because it's like Les Thatcher said, it's a hobby to them. You know, it's something to do either, you know, on the weekends or you know, a couple nights a week when they're not doing anything. You know, it's not necessarily their fault. They can't make a living. Nobody can make a living at it anymore except for the fortunate few who end up working for, you know, New York. I don't even think that a lot of the TNA guys are working strictly for them. I think they're working for whoever they can work for on top of them. Unless, you know, it's the Hogans and people like that who are already somewhat fairly secure in their lives. But the rest of them, you know, the middle of the card guys, you know, they're having to scrape and get whatever they can, wherever they can. And it's just, you know, you can't make a living at it anymore.
So if you
want to be in the wrestling business, that's what you know. You have to do it as a hobby, unless you're just absolutely, you know, best thing since sliced bread and can get right away. Get with one of the big boys.
And how long is that run for? Then what? You know
exactly.
And I'm sure the wrestling in Japan is no more as of right now. You know. What few Americans,
it's still there, but it's not as strong as it used to be. They're still wrestling in Europe, but it's basically been replaced by, you know, what they see on TV here, because they don't have their own television, they don't have their own promotions, other than small ones. I've got a friend of mine who lives in Huntsville. He just moved back here a few years ago from Germany, and he was involved in promotions over there, and in fact, Ted Allen went to work for him a couple times over there, and you know, it's doing what they see on WWE. They don't, you know, the old European style of the round system and all that is pretty much died away. I don't know for sure that they don't have their own promotions anymore, but they're nothing like they used to be profitable.
They used to have it in France, Belgium, Germany. I mean, it was just...
Yep.
Anyhow.
Well, speaking of foreigners, it kind of gets us to our subject. You did that very well, Jerry. You opened that door to segue real well.
Did I slip that in there?
I'll have to give you a pay raise for that.
He didn't know what he was doing, but he did it well, didn't he?
I've heard that before, Bobby.
Yeah, me too.
What I wanted to talk about tonight was the rise of the foreign heels. It seemed that every territory had them. They seem to have started right around the end of World War II, and I guess basically lasted up until the end of the Cold War in the mid-'80s. Prior to that, there were guys who were Germans and Japanese and all that that weren't, but they didn't have that gimmick about them like they did after the end of the Second World War. And for some reason, prior to the Second World War, all the foreign heels seemed to be English lords. Going all the way back to the days of Lord Patrick Lansdowne and Lord James Bleers and that in the 40s and early 50s. But then right around the early 50s is when the Germans and Japanese, because of the, I guess, the instant heat they could draw, because it was that close to being after the Second World War, that started up, and it just lasted for 40 years. The territory here didn't have that many. I can remember this territory seemed to use, especially in the 50s, used Mexican heels. They were all like supposed to be bandits, like if you guys remember Roberto Pico, Pancho Villa. He was big here. I think he worked some in Georgia as well. I'm not sure which name he used, but he did the whole gimmick with the big sombrero and had a pit bull that he would come to the ring with. And another one was Chico Cortez, who was a Cuban heel before anybody had ever heard of Cuba. He was doing the Cuban assassin gimmick with the army fatigues and the cigar and what was it, Bobby? Baking powder or something.
Well, he wore army fatigues. It was like had those pockets all up and down the legs, and he'd have baking soda in one, and he'd have baby powder in one. He'd tote salt in one, and his matches generally didn't last too long. The funny story I ever heard about him was Rocket, there's a lot of funny stories about him, but Rocket Monroe said Chico was in Huntsville one night, and Nick Gulas told him, he said, look, boy, he said, you go out there, he said, but I don't want to see no powder or none of that stuff. And they said about 2 minutes into the match, he said, you couldn't see the ring for the cloud of dust in the air. Baby powder and baking soda and everything, you know. It was just, Chico was one of a kind.
I would say, of course, Chico, his actual wrestling was really secondary to his selling pictures and calendars.
Gary, did you ever work with Chico?
No, not that I know of.
Oh, listen. He was only, what was he, Mike? He was about 5 feet tall, maybe?
Yeah, about that.
I mean, a little short guy. But he had gimmicks. He sold pictures, and I mean, he made more money doing this stuff than he did the other thing. He'd make these calendars up on this 11x17 Xerox paper, and he would take little pictures of everybody that. And I've got one here somewhere at the house, you know. But he'd put these little pictures all over the thing, and he'd sell them as his wrestling calendar, you know. And the pictures sometimes were 50 years old. And you didn't know who the people were, but it was his wrestling. But he made a lot of money doing this stuff. But he's in Tennessee, and Tex Riley was him and Lynn Rossi were tag partners. They were the tag team champions, and Tex was fixing to go to Japan, and they were going to drop the belts and wherever they were. It might have been Huntsville. I don't know. They were going to drop the belts, so. Just before the matches start, Chico gets the microphone and he goes, "Ladies and gentlemen. Last chance to get your pictures of Tex Riley. He leaves for Japan in the morning." They said Gulas had, you know, Gulas would fire him, run him off, but he'd bring him right back and sell the gimmicks. But the greatest Chico Cortez story of any of them. Tex Riley died in Savannah, Georgia, in 1961-62. Or maybe a little later. It might have been 65. I don't know.
64, I think.
64, anyway. He died there. So Chico is riding with Lynn Rossi in Tennessee going to a town, and they saw a dog on the side of the road. Now, this is a true story. And Chico tells Rossi, he said, "Pull over, let me get the dog. He said, looks like a good pet." So Rossi stops, and they pick the dog up. And they get to town that night. Rossi said he's sitting in the dressing room lacing his boots up. And he says he hear Chico outside on the PA system. He said, "Ladies and gentlemen," he said, "we're going to have an auction tonight." He said, "Our friend and great wrestler Tex Riley has died, and I have his pet dog here, and we're going to auction it off." And he sold the dog. You know, it's just, yeah. You just can't be.
I wonder how many times he told that same dog.
Oh, jeez.
It's like Rocky McGuire always. Once or twice a year, he'd auction off a pony. And it always ended up his daughter always
wanted. Yeah. back to your foreign wrestlers. That was Chico. You shouldn't have brought Chico up so early in the show.
But then, you know, the German guy, the first German heel, and of course, you know, like I said, there were Germans that worked, you know, back in those, or guys who used German names, I should say. But none of them did the full-blown Nazi gimmick. I think the first one I ever heard of, starting in the early to mid-50s, was Carl von Hess, who worked, of course, you know, up in the Northeast, worked in Chicago, worked in Texas. There was a guy that started not long after him that never really worked much outside of the Pacific Northwest, and that was Herbline Poppenheim. In fact, he and Von Hess would team up. He called himself Eric Von Hess whenever he would team up with Carl Von Hess. And then, of course, Fritz von Erich came along after that. But I think the toppers, in my opinion, the ones that took it to the top level were the Von Brauners.
Without a doubt.
Oh.
Did you ever work with them at all? The original version, I guess, was by the time you got in the business, the original Carl Von Hess had dropped out, and it was Eric and Kurt.
I only worked with them
Donovan
one time.
Brothers, Red and Doug Donovan.
One time.
I heard they were great wrestlers. I've seen videotape of them, but I never saw them. I never got to see them live. But I have seen videos of them. And, you know, they are, or at least Saul Weingroth, the guy that was their manager, was directly responsible for Gordon Sully getting in the wrestling business. You heard that story?
I have not heard that one.
Evidently, the guy who did the television for that, and back in those days, it was Cowboy Luttrell in Tampa, was a guy who also did the kiddie television show. He was like a sailor or something, and that was his gimmick. He was called Salty Saul Fleischman. And he got, so, of course, he wasn't smart for the business, but he got so upset at Saul Weingroth, being Jewish, managing those Nazis, that he walked off in the middle of the television program.
No
and
kid.
And they hired Gordon Sully.
And the rest is history, right?
Yes, sir.
When I first started going to the matches, the first big heel tag team I ever remember were the Von Brauners, and man, they had some heat. Good gracious,
they looked the part, didn't they?
Yes, they did. Charlie Smith can probably relate the story better than I can, but he said they had so much heat in Marietta one night at that old Larry Bell Auditorium. One of the Von Brauners was hurt, and Saul had to wrestle. And they were wrestling Tex Riley and somebody. Might have been Joe Scarpa. I can't remember who Charlie said it was. But they did some kind of deal where Saul hit one of them with a cane or with a bell or something. And Smitty said the ring filled up with people. And it was so bad and so hot that Buddy Fuller, who was one of the top babyfaces at the time, ran in the ring to help. And they said they cut him from one side to the other. So it was just a bad scene. But that's the kind of heat they had around here.
And of course, like any successful gimmick, you know, they spawned a lot of imitators, the Von Stroheims, Carl and Kurt von Stroheim, which Kurt von Stroheim became the second Carl von Brauner after Jimmy Brauner quit, or at least quit teaming with Doug Donovan. And then there were the Von Steigers, and just hundreds of them. Kurt von Hess and Carl von Schatz. They were a little bit later on. They were in the 70s. And there was only, other than Jimmy Brauner and Willie, what was his name? Willie Rutgowski, who was Kurt von Stroheim, Carl von Brauner, and Walter Nuremberg, who was Karl von Strahm. Those were the only two Germans out of all of them. The rest of them were just doing their thing. That's like all the Japanese wrestlers that were really Mexicans and Hawaiians. And I think the first real Japanese heel was Mr. Moto out of California, who was Hawaiian-Japanese. And, of course, he naturally sprung a ton of imitators, Mitsuo Arakawa. In here, there was the great Shiroma, Haru Sasaki. I think the best I ever saw and at this and probably had the longest career was Tanaka, Toru Tanaka. And, of course, he was Hawaiian, as was Tojo Yamamoto.
The best one I ever saw.
The guy we talked about last week, Oki Shikina, who was both. That was somebody.
Yeah.
Oki Shikina. So he worked both ways.
The best one I ever saw, and I had the pleasure to be in the ring with him, was Matsuda. I don't know if y'all was ever around him or. I mean, what a.
I saw him work. He was a tremendous worker.
Oh, gosh.
That's true, because he and Duke Kiyomoka really started about the same time Moto did.
But yeah, I would imagine.
They were, yeah.
But Matsuda
was a worker.
There's no doubt.
Not only was Matsuda a great worker, if the need arose, he could pull your lungs out through your ears. you were just dropping back on the Germans, you know, and I tell you, a guy made a lot of money in his career and went a lot of places was Waldo von Erich.
Yeah, he did.
He was in here for a while, and he was even after he was here in the 80s. I guess it was late 70s, early 80s. He came through here, but he was there again, drew a lot of heat, and. All he had to do was put that silver helmet on and go to the ring, and that's all it took.
It made me hot.
Oh, yeah.
You know, he was able to retire fairly young, too. He was, maybe mid-40s, late-40s when he retired. And he invented some sort of exercise equipment when he returned to Canada, which is where he was from. And he got patents on all kinds of exercise chairs or some sort of chairs and stuff like that he invented. And that's what he did until he passed away. He was involved in doing stuff like that. But you're right, he was another one that drew a lot. And Baron von Raschke was another one. And
yeah,
you're talking about somebody that was totally opposite of his true nature. I mean, as far as that got into the gimmick was von Raschke, because Jim Raschke, I should say, is totally opposite of Baron von Raschke.
Totally.
Of course, you guys work with him more than I was around him.
He was a nice guy, man.
Yes, very much so. And, you know, there's another guy, you know. I don't know. Y'all may disagree. You know, as far as a worker was concerned, I thought he was just so-so. As a matter of fact, he was kind of clumsy. But that's another guy that, you know, if the need arose, he could snatch you and make you understand.
Yes, he could. Yes, he could.
We were talking about Matsuda. You guys ever hear the story of him wanting to challenge Danny Hodge in the gym? You ever heard that story?
Never heard that one.
No, me neither.
He wanted to try out Danny Hodge. And of course, they had a long thing going work-wise because they swapped the world junior heavyweight belt around. But he just had always heard, you know, what a good shooter Danny was, so he wanted to try him. But he was going to be prepared. He paid Carl Gotch $10,000 to teach him some hooks. And now this was, you know, out of the. Sight of an audience or anything. They just strictly did this in the gym. what I hear, when Matsuda was on the match with Hodge about 3 minutes, and said, "Well, that was $10,000 I wasted."
Gosh, didn't show him enough, did he?
I just don't think he ever got a chance to grab a hook.
Listen,
Danny just knotted him up.
This is totally changing the subject here, but you heard the story about Ole going down to visit Thez in Florida and wanting to go down and work out with Thez on a match, didn't you?
I heard him tell it.
Yeah, he said he told Lou, he said, "You know, man," he said, "I've heard all these stories. Let's go down and work out." Now Ole was, you know, 60 years old, and Thez is probably 80. And they go down on the mat, and Thez told him, he said, "No, when you're wrestling a guy in a gym, Ole," he said, "the first thing you have to do, you always expect the unexpected." And Ole said, "Yes, I do." He said, "Now remember, always expect the unexpected." And Ole said, "Well, I do." When he did, Thez headbutted him in the nose. And when Ole reached up and grabbed his nose, Thez hooked him, took him down on the mat. And Ole said all he could scream was, "Lou, I'm a 60-year-old man. Turn me loose."
You got to keep that reputation.
Yes, sir. Yes, sir. As far as I'm concerned, Mr. Thez was the epitome of what our business should be.
Yeah, he
what a class act.
I never saw that man without a coat and tie on.
No, sir, me neither. Yeah.
I liked him. He's a nice man.
I did, too. I tell people all the time, you know, and a lot of folks don't understand this, I was very proud that he spoke to me on a first-name basis. I mean, I was like, man, this guy knows me. This is really, you know, amazing.
I get that feeling every March when Danny Hodge, whether I'm wearing a name badge or not, remembers my name.
Yep.
This is somebody who has... When you think of the thousands of people that he has met and talked to and dealt with over his career and still deals with. I mean,
he's still living in Oklahoma.
Still in Perry, Oklahoma, where he was born and raised. Still there. And I guess he'll be there until.
Maybe.
He's still... I tell people all the time the four most dangerous words in the wrestling business, and still to this day to me, is when Danny Hodge with that soft voice says, "Let me show you something."
Yeah, right.
That's okay. I'll pass on that one.
Thank you.
When you're shaking his hand and you know that because of his reputation, you're always hesitant to begin with. But then it slowly starts to tighten up, and his left hand starts inching up your forearm to your elbow. I'm going to die.
And you realize you have made a serious mistake.
Yeah. All the time he's just smiling away, just that little light voice of his. Oh, unbelievable. Well, back to our subject. Another thing that nationality, I guess, that... and probably lasted longer than any of them because of the Cold War, which was the Russians. I know the first Russian that worked in here as doing a heel Russian gimmick, which, again, there were guys that were of Russian nationality or had Russian or used Russian names that didn't play it up. But the first one here was the original Great Malenko. Did you guys know that there was one before Larry Simon?
Never knew that. Who was he?
Guy from Hamilton, one of those guys that came out of the Hamilton factory up there, a guy by the name of Frank Fozzo. He worked in here in the mid-50s, well, all the way through the late 50s as the Great Malenko, and there was also a Boris Malenko before Larry Simon.
Didn't know that either.
Yeah, guy that, his name was John Carney, of all things, for our business. What a name! What an appropriate last name.
Yep, that fit the bill.
He worked under the name Ivan Kamarov as well, so he was better known as Ivan Kamarov, but he did for a short while use the name Boris Malenko. And then, of course, then the Russian tag teams, the Kalmakovs and the Volkovs and the Smith brothers, who worked did the cough drop brother with the big mustaches and beards. They did that gimmick all over the South, and then they switched and became the Russian Wolfman and were Soldat and Ivan Gorky. If you guys ever saw him, but John Smith, you probably knew Jerry from down in Tampa. Wolfman John Smith?
Yes.
That had that bar?
Yes.
He was still working up until, I guess, the early 80s. So he worked from almost 40 years. It was a grizzled old veteran. You could see the broken bones and everything, but he was one of those that you didn't want to mess with. You could tell by looking at him. He knew something. I guess, but there again, the one that took it to the ultimate height and that lived the gimmick and probably did it better than anybody, in my opinion, was Ivan Koloff. You
know? Yeah, he did.
And you would have never known he was a French Canadian by listening to him talk.
How's Ivan doing now?
Health-wise, he's still making public appearances, but he can't get in a ring anymore. He last time I saw him, he was limping pretty bad, using a cane, and he's still sharp as ever, but he's just not getting around as good as he used to. Of course, I guess that could be said for any of us.
Two or three years ago, he was in a car wreck, he and his wife.
Yeah. What a nice guy.
He is. He stretched it. He started that gimmick in the late 60s, and he was probably working to the very end, to the late 90s, with he and Nikita Koloff and Barry Darso doing the Crusher Khrushchev. They were, of course, with Crockett's when they became World Championship Wrestling, and they were probably the last ones to do that type of gimmick.
Jim Nelson.
That's right, Jim Nelson is more Zukov.
Now, doesn't he live in Mobile?
No, Jim lives in Virginia or West Virginia.
Really?
He lives up north, yeah. He came to Mobile a few years ago to the reunion. That's the last time I saw him.
I thought sure he was in Mobile.
That's a guy that you know, he used to come to TV in Atlanta and do jobs for guys. And mm-hmm. then he just kept working at his craft and finally got a break. Got the biggest head on a body I ever seen in my life.
Yes, that.
Yes, sir. Got a big old head.
No way you can buy a hat.
And when he shaved it, that just...
It made it bigger,
for a Russian gimmick, that just made it bigger.
Yeah.
No way you can buy a hat. I mean, he couldn't.
He could buy two caps and put them together. They'd have two bills.
Yeah, he could. But Jim was a nice guy. He was
nice guy. Yes, he
was a nice guy. He is a nice guy. And then somewhere along the line, they imported in Samoans and people from the Fiji Islands. They were, up until the original Samoans, Reno and Tio, they were usually baby faces because back in the 50s, you had Prince Maivia and then Peter Maivia and Alo Kahani, I think it's Pihali or whatever his name was another one. But they were always, you know, the cheerful baby faces. Pony Wiki Wiki, if you guys remember him.
Know the name. Never met him.
But then I guess Afa and Sika were the first to actually work heel, and they started out as baby faces. They worked in here as baby faces, and they worked in Detroit and various places. But then when Reno and Tio morphed from being Samoans into being Manchurians, or whatever nationality they became, that's when the Islanders went to being the Samoans. Now, have you guys heard the story how they got in the business? Afa and Sika. Sika told me this. They were, even though they're Samoan, they grew up in San Francisco. And they would go to Shire shows out there. Well, the heels were terrified of them because they were so big and so mean. All the heels were terrified of them because they'd get in fights with them and everything, and they'd beat up the heels. So finally they talked Shire into breaking them into the business. So they quit getting beat up. All the heels. His heels did.
I think those island boys are tough now. I don't think they're not.
Yeah, they are.
Snooker was probably the best worked out of all of them.
Yeah, Seeker's a good guy. I haven't seen him in a couple of years. He lives right over in Gulf Breeze, outside of Pensacola. He hasn't been to the reunion in the last couple of years, but he's a good guy. And what a family.
I was talking about Jimmy Snooker. Snooker was probably the best worker of the whole crowd. I don't know if y'all was around
unless
him.
Unless you put a microphone in front of him.
Yeah.
I had the pleasure of working with him one time, and I just knew he was going to kill me. Because his finisher was that jump off the top rope, and I thought, oh, Lord, how am I going to take this? You know, I never felt a thing.
Jimmy was good.
Light as a feather. He was light as a feather. He was in Atlanta during the Sistrunk era. Team Gordy made a good team. I mean, I always thought that Slicker was a better heel than he was a babyface. He just had that look about him.
Yeah. But I guess all those days are gone, aren't they, about, you know, the different nationalities. And
it don't matter who you put in there now. Nobody knows who the heel or who the baby face is.
Well, that's true, too.
I mean, you know.
Well, you wouldn't know.
No, you don't. I mean, the one thing about, I mean, our business, you know, and I know, Jerry, you've heard this, and I know Mike's heard it, but we were taught from the get-go. I mean, from you know, I don't care who you work for or where you work, if you got in this business, you were told, it's like telling a story. There's got to be a beginning, there has to be a middle, there has to be an end. It's got to have continuity to it. It's got to kind of flow. And, you know, in order for that to happen, and in order to keep people coming back to see how the story's going to unfold, they got to see somebody. They got to want to see somebody get their brains kicked in.
That's it.
I mean, if you put Jerry Oates and Dick Steinborn against each other, and they go out and have a 15-minute scientific match, I'll give you a better example than that. There's a 15-minute draw out there on video you can find with Dickie and Tommy Siegler. Probably one of the best 15-minute matches I've ever seen in my life. Two baby faces, great match. But you could have brought that match back next week with a 30-minute time limit, and it wouldn't have drawn 15 cents. Because as good as it was to somebody that knew the business to enjoy that, the fans, you know, they want to see somebody get their face kicked in.
They were bored by it.
They were bored by it, yeah. So, you know, you got to have somebody that the fans want to see get beat. And those days of the Germans and the Japanese teams and the Russians, those were natural people that the American people disliked for what they had been through with war and whatever. Now, who are our next? I mean, you know, I guess you could have a guy with a Arab gimmick or with a, you know, a Taliban gimmick or something, but, you know. But, yeah, I mean, I don't know. You know, the Iron Sheik, we didn't mention him. When he came along with the Iran thing right after that deal broke out, you know, he was a natural enemy. People disliked the Iranis at the time. But, you know, now you don't know one from the other.
Well, I think also, I don't know, just from what I've heard, I think Vince tried to do a Middle Eastern heel gimmick back a few years ago, right after we first went into Iraq, and the heat that they drew was not from the fans. It wasn't from the audience. They're so conditioned that, you know, they already know it's a show. You know, they're just looking for whoever says the funniest things. They're looking for more comedy than anything else, but they drew heat from outside sources that caused them to kill that gimmick.
Probably.
And I think, maybe our society has gotten too politically correct for stuff like that to even work anymore. I don't know. It just seemed, you know, more natural back in our days to have those. And you're right, Bobby, about the Arabs. You know, it's funny, back in the early days of the business, the Arabs were all usually baby faces. The one of the first ones to do the Sheik gimmick was a guy by the name of Sheik Bin Ali, who usually worked as a babyface, who also happened to have two nephews that came into the wrestling business, one named Skandar Akbar, the other the great Mephisto, Frankie Kane. He was the Sheik before Ed Farhad ever became the Sheik. And then and that's another one, Farhad, I guess it's from him living that gimmick. People were terrified of him because he was so wild and everything. But then his matches got so one-dimensional. I mean, somebody on one of the message boards I was on the other day was talking about his matches in Toronto. He worked up there quite a bit for Frank Tony, but those people, you know, they were used to the main event, which he was in, only being 3 or 4 minutes long. Because that's the way he worked it. You know, he came out there, got blood, got juice on his opponent, and got the crowd so heated up, he skipped out and went to the dressing room and never finished the match. That went on for 10 years, but he still drew, which is amazing to me. You know how your main event's going to end every week, every month, however often they ran. I don't see how that would draw. But
he got away with it for years, though.
He made it work in Detroit for 30 years. So.
He sure did.
I don't know. And then in the same category, Abdullah the Butcher. Of course, Abdullah was a little more diversified until he gained so much weight and got so immobile. But if you've ever seen video of Abby working, especially in Australia, he was over there for a year or 2 years, and they had a big thing over there between he and Marv Lewin that drew week in, week out. But Abby was real mobile, would take bumps, would do a little bit of flying and all that stuff, and could really work a good match. And then still work that madman gimmick as well. I guess after him was Kamala. That's another thing, like Baron Von Raschke. You can't find somebody more further away from his gimmick than Jimmy Harris was. But he was a nice guy, too.
Yeah, he had a run at it now. I don't think he did.
Oh, yeah. He made some big change doing that. What other nationality was there? There was Mongols. Well, I tell you, now that Archie Goldie, I was a grown man working in the business, and he still scared me.
He worked hard, let me tell you.
If you ever had some of them boots put on your forehead, it'd make you scared.
He scared me. I was just sitting in the audience.
Where is he now?
Still in Knoxville, as far as
well,
I know. Somebody
Knoxville,
was saying,
yeah. He was working for a sheriff's department or something.
He what?
Yeah, I don't think he's doing that now. I don't think he's just about to where he can't get around. He's almost in a wheelchair, but Bo James was telling me.
Oh, okay.
At the reunion a couple of weeks ago. But, yeah, he was up until this recently, he was still riding a bicycle several miles to work every day, and he was teaching hand-to-hand combat to the sheriff's department or whatever it was he worked for. Which I could see him doing that. He was from Calgary or Edmonton, one or the other. he broke in, it's too hard.
You were talking about the Mongols, and what I get the guy's names. What was the guy out of Pittsburgh?
Dave Patrick.
Yeah. Him and you know, Nikolai Volkov, or went on to be Nikolai Volkov. You know, started out that thing, and then Bill Eadie came in when Volkov broke off and became a Russian. Yeah, those guys made some money too. They were unique. Especially around here, when they came in working for Ann. We were still running with Ann, and you know, the only Mongol Guinea we'd had around here was El Mongo. Of course, he was a babyface, and they brought those two guys in, and there again, it created a natural rivalry between him and those guys. There again,
I should have asked him who came up with that. He was a Mongol from Peru.
Yeah.
I guess maybe he was kidnapped.
Yeah, that's another.
That could have been.
That, you know, the thing you talk about, Bill Eadie. You know, how about you know the Mongol gimmick and Bill Eadie? What a, you know, that just it doesn't add up unless you know the guy.
Well, you know, the thing, amazing thing about him was he finished up as Bolo Mongol on one night. The next night worked as the Masked Superstar, and totally changed the way he worked. And everything, and nobody had a clue. Nobody had a clue.
Yeah,
that's something.
I don't think until the internet came along, anybody ever had a clue that Billy Eadie was one of the Mongols.
He told me this story sitting in the dressing room. You know, Bill. I want to say he went to the University of West Virginia. I'm not. I may have the school wrong, but you know, Bill's got a degree. Bill's, you know, he's a teacher now. That's what he's doing. He lives here in Atlanta. And he's a teacher. He teaches at a juvenile detention facility, you know. And he told me, he said one of his first nights in the business, they did TV in Pittsburgh, and he said they had a 2-out-of-3-fall match, and he said they went to the dressing room between falls. And he said they had a match, you know, they went out in the first fall and did a few things, and he said there was a little commotion on the front row, and he said he didn't pay much attention to it. He said they came out in the second fall, and he said, during the second fall, some guy on the front row died of a heart attack. I mean, just right there on the front row, died. He said they finished the second fall and went to the dressing room. And he said, of course, they held the matches up for a long time because, you know, they had to get the guy out of there, evidently. He said when he come back out, he said the most remarkable thing that he found when he got back in the ring at night was the guy's family was still on the front row.
They didn't leave.
They stayed there. Basically, they wanted to see. He said, one of them said there wasn't nothing we could do for him. He was dead. We want to see the end of the match.
Well, they had a point.
So they're all right there on the front row. He said that was sort of his introduction to the avidness of the wrestling fan.
I saw him haul somebody out of this auditorium in Mobile. He died of a heart. I don't know if he died or not. He had a heart attack. He was up in the balcony, and they worked on him forever on the floor there, and never stopped the match. I don't remember who was even working. They might even have two matches while all that was going on. I don't think other than me, I don't think anybody was looking up there.
Well,
they were watching what was going on in the ring.
This isn't wrestling, but this is here again, just to show you that how people are. Me and my wife went to see Hank Williams Jr. at the Omni in Atlanta, and we're sitting there and we're watching the show. And I'd go to these shows and I'd get the cheap seats and sit upstairs because I didn't go to participate in whatever was going on. I'd go to see the performer, and you know. But there was a lady there went into labor. I mean, she physically, water broke, full-blown labor. They got the paramedics there. They got her on the thing. And the guy that she's with, I don't know if it was her husband, boyfriend, whatever he was begging her, honey, please don't go yet. Hank's fixing to come home. Please, can you wait just a few minutes? Mindy, my wife looked at me. She said, I get you. I said, well, this isn't over yet. There may be a killing here before it's over. But, you know, wait, baby, I paid a lot of money for these tickets.
That sounds no like refund. A Jeff Foxworthy joke right there. You might be a redneck if you were born in a Hank Williams Jr. concert.
Hey, you go on the road, Mike.
Yes, sir. Oh.
Wow. Unbelievable.
Yeah, I you know.
Anybody heard anything about Orndorff, the latest?
I haven't heard anything.
Haven't heard anything more, which is, I guess, good news. No news is good news in that case.
Yes, it is. I don't know if anybody had heard.
Haven't heard any more on Stubbs other than the fact that he was home.
Yeah, I haven't heard any more, so I'm assuming that's good news. Last I heard, he was at home and he was doing well.
That's wonderful.
I sent him an email, and I said, we at the Gulf Coast Reunion Board have voted you a special award, the person who would do the most and go the furthest to keep from coming to Mobile. Let's see, go to the reunion and schedule open heart surgery.
Oh.
I guess you didn't hear back from him.
No, I haven't heard back.
Oh,
who was at the reunion that hadn't been there in a long time? Danny Miller.
Well, Danny's been coming pretty regular. Danny was there, but he's been there the last two
four
or three
years. Yeah,
is that right? Was Stu Schwartz there?
Stu was back.
Stu was
and Barney
there, yes.
Was back. The first time they'd been back. I think they missed 2 years, the last 2 years. I think Bonnie had some health issues, but they were back and looked in great shape. Dagmar was there for the second time this year, and she had a ball. She had a ball.
She was something else.
This is the first time I've ever been around her.
Who was it she pulled the gun on?
Susan Green.
Susan Green, that's right. And you know, they did the little show thing down there, and Susan Green did this deal where she was dressed like, what, Alan Jackson or something?
Alan Jackson.
And it was like a love song, and she went up toward Dagmar and said, well, I forget what the lyrics were. Anyway, Dagmar went in her pocketbook and pulled a gun out. And what nobody knew at the time was she had got the gun from Randall Brown, and it was real, and it was loaded. Randall Brown said he liked to die, and he said if she'd have pulled that trigger, we'd all been in the newspaper.
Where's Dagmar living now?
She's still in Columbia.
Columbia.
She's in Columbia,
yeah.
South Carolina. Yeah.
I used to haul her sometimes. She was funny. I mean, she was funny. She looked like a little Cupid doll.
Mm-hmm.
That long hair and
she's a nice lady. Real nice lady. I can't think of anybody who was there this year that hadn't been there in a while or was there for the first time.
Other than Stu and Bonnie, they keep coming back. They hadn't been there in a few years. You mentioned Danny Miller. Danny and his wife and Bill Dromo and Karen Dromo are big friends.
Right.
And they come up and stay with Bill and Karen a couple times during the year. So that they actually make it up this way every once in a while.
How's Bill doing?
He's doing okay. He's holding his own. I mean, the Parkinson's getting a little worse. He has bad days as far as his breathing is concerned, but he's holding his own. He's doing well. The 26th of June, him and Miss Karen will celebrate 50 years being married. Really? I told Karen, I said, you deserve a Medal of Honor.
Yes, she does, sir. How's Ole doing?
Charlie said he's doing okay. He's rented him a little place on the outskirts of Atlanta, and he's staying closer to his doctor, and also his friend Marsha helps look in on him, so he's not by himself. So that's he's holding his own. Just there again, the disease is very slowly getting him.
Well, I think he's, after this last bout, maybe he'll realize if he quit trying to do all the things that he tries to do. What was it, a couple of years ago, he fell off the roof?
That's what started all of it. That's what triggered everything. Yeah. When he fell off the roof, he's trying to clean the gutters out. Like he ain't got enough money to pay somebody to clean the gutters out.
That's why he's got money.
Yeah.
That's probably true, but when he fell off and broke that hip, it cost him $32,000 cash to get that hip replaced because he didn't have no insurance. He wished he'd have paid somebody $25 to clean him gutters out.
I wonder if he still got that Ford LTD.
No, he got rid of it.
The convertible.
Yeah, brown Ford LTD convertible.
I wonder how many miles that thing ended up with.
Almost 400,000, he told me. He I probably told y'all this. He called me. I was sitting in the ticket office one day, and he came. He said, "Come here, help me." I said, "What are we going to do?" He said, "We're going to change the fuel filter." I said, "Well, okay." So we walk outside, and the fuel filter on that Ford, he had that big four-barrel carburetor on there, and it just screwed into the side of the carburetor housing. I mean, it wasn't no big deal. You didn't have to take, didn't lose no fuel, didn't take no line or nothing. You just screwed it out and screwed it back in. He said, "I need to see if it leaks." He said, "Start it up." I said, "All right." I got down on my hands and knees in front of it, and I was looking under it. And he said, "What are you doing?" I said, "I'm looking for that crank you let down to get, you know, to turn it over." Oh.
Yeah, I bet that endeared you to him real quick.
Oh, listen. I don't know if Jerry's heard this or not. I know I've told you, but, you know, Ole's got such a sense of humor. It's hard to get him to laugh. I mean, he'll never put you over. We were in Marietta one Sunday night, and I was refereeing, and we come out of the ring. It might have been him and Koloff teamed up. I can't remember who it was. But, I learned a long time ago, if there's any heat in a match at all, you follow the heels out. Number one, you can watch your back. Number two, you got more police protection. So I'd rolled out of the ring, and I was about three steps behind Ole, and some guy sitting on the end of the row had a motorcycle helmet in his hand. And when Ole went by, he windmilled that motorcycle helmet like you would a softball pitch, and he come right down on top of Ole's head with it. I mean, he crowned him. Ole took about two steps. He didn't put the guy over. He took about two steps and reached up and touched his head like a fly had hit him or something. Well, when he turned around, I had already hit the guy, and I was proceeding to put the bottom of my shoe on him. And the cops are trying to pull me back, and Ole comes back up there. And Ole never touched the guy. Ole never touched him. And the cops told him, he said, "Look," he said, "help us get this guy outside." And Ole said, "If I touch him, he'll sue me." He said, "No, I won't. We'll tell him what happened." So Ole front face locked the guy and led the guy right out the back door. And when they got outside, he turns the guy loose, and the guy's up against the wall, and they exchange a few words, and Ole turns around, comes back in the dressing room. When he gets back there, Ole, I mean, he's had a knot on his head the size of a baseball. He screamed bloody murder. And, I mean, guy liked to kill him. So I just went ahead and changed clothes and got out of there because I figured they was going to get me. Next day, I'm sitting in the office. Telephone rings, and it's Ole. I said, "Where you at?" He said, "I'm at the Cobb County Jail." I said, "For what?" And he said, "Well, the guy took out a warrant against me for assault." And I said, "Assault?" He said, "Yeah." He said, "I never touched a guy other than what the cops told me to do." He said, "You hit him." I said, "Hey, you know, I'm trying to keep him off you." And he said, "Well, the guy told me, he said, if I'd come down here and turn myself in, they'd walk me through here and they'd let me out on my own recognizance." And I said, "You're in the jail." He said, "Well, I'm inside the jail building, yeah." And I told him, I said, "Well, let me tell you something, Ole. If this is your one phone call they're allowing you, you have made a very serious mistake." The only time I ever cracked him up. Of course, after he quit laughing, he threatened to kill me. But, you know, it was just normal.
whatever become of that? Anything?
Nah, nothing. It got kicked out. It got kicked out. That was... He,
I wonder how somebody would react if that happened to say, Triple H or something like that happened today.
No. It will not happen because they don't have any heat. If let me tell you something. If Jerry Oates was wrestling Rocket Monroe, if Jerry Oates was wrestling Sputnik Monroe, if Jerry Oates was wrestling whoever, it was a heel. Buddy Colt, it was a heel. And they got out on the floor, and they'd went up in the bleachers. Somebody would have come back stabbed.
There's no doubt about that.
Oh, absolutely.
Somebody would have come back stabbed. And them guys go up in there and dance with the fans.
And the fans just laugh.
And they just laugh and pat them on the back and mug for the camera. I mean, they have no heat.
And have you noticed they don't scatter?
No, they don't scatter.
In our day, they scattered.
I mean,
they don't scatter.
I was involved in a couple of the Sheik Abdullah matches where we got out into the crowd.
And those two could scatter a crowd bigger than anybody I've ever seen. Especially
I was involved in a few of those melees, and you know that was
in the Omni, man. I couldn't believe what I was seeing.
Jeez,
it's one of them, both of them got the guts cut out.
Oh yeah,
it's black to not believe it.
If you've ever seen videotape of Abdullah and Brody in Puerto Rico, they had the military surrounding the ring there.
That's one dangerous place, my friend. Did you go down there when Ann was running, Bobby?
No, I never made the trip. I knew I didn't want to go when the guys come back and said there was kids standing outside the stadium selling rocks for a penny apiece.
That's right, right. Yeah, I made that.
Well, there's you some foreign heels right there, the kids in Puerto Rico.
Oh.
I got a note from a friend of mine, Dale Ingram, the guy that helped us get El Mongol on here. He sent me a note today and said, well, if you're talking about foreign heels, does that include all those masked men from parts unknown? Is that a foreign country?
That's a good one.
I got a guy that comes to Vegas from parts unknown. I can put on y'all.
This mascara.
For you. When you go out there in a couple of weeks, you're going to have some people on the plane with you from parts unknown.
Oh, jeez.
Mascara show up out there, Bobby.
He was there last year. He came in on the banquet's Wednesday night. He came in on Wednesday morning. Set up his little gimmick table and sold his mask, and then he was at the thing. Never took his mask off there the whole time.
Well, Mascara's got to be on up there now.
Yeah, he still looks good as long as
his
mask on.
Did you know he was Mr. Mexico?
No, I didn't.
Yeah. I think he's 60.
I know he was in a lot of movies down there. I've seen some of those. But
yeah, well, you know how that came about, that character, because of the popularity of Blue Demon and El Santo and those movies that they made back in the 40s and 50s. Rodriguez or Mil Mascaras was actually a, as Jerry said, a bodybuilder. He was something to do with martial arts, did karate or something like judo or something. So he had an athletic background, but they hired him strictly to star in those movies. They created that character as a movie character, and the movies became so popular that he became a wrestler. So he got in the business just the opposite of the rest of them. But the one time I saw him live, I was disappointed in him, but I have seen videotapes. I think it depends on who he works with as to how good he works. Guys who won't let him get away with not selling and stuff like that. If you've ever seen matches of him working with Dick Byer, of course you're going to sell for Dick Byer regardless whether you want to or not, because he's another one of those that will make you want to. But he's actually a fairly decent worker when the right mood hits him. But yeah, as far as I know, he still works.
I was in Japan with him and Harley. And don't think Harley and him had some heat. Harley wouldn't even speak to him the whole time. Wouldn't even talk to him. He was... I don't think he wasn't a star over there now. I mean, he was big in Japan.
Oh, yeah.
He'd been going over there for God knows how long. There's no telling what kind of money he paid him.
Did you ever work with either one of his brothers?
No, but I was around him, Psychedelico and...
Yeah.
And his other brother was in Japan with him.
Dos Caras, yeah.
Yeah.
Well, Dos Caras' son is the one that's the big healing for Vince right now. Alberto Del Rio, I guess is what they're calling. That's Dos Caras' son.
Is that right?
And Psychedelico, I think, traveled, worked more places in the States than Dos Caras did. Mascaras obviously worked more places because he was such an attraction, but Psychedelico worked here for a while. Yeah, Psychedelico worked here for a month or so. I know he was in Florida for a while.
He was here everyone here long, Mike.
Who, Psychedelico?
Yeah, he wasn't here long.
Yeah. I think Georgia, about the same time that he was in Florida, he worked the Southeast. There was a few of those guys from L.A., I think, that were touring the Southeast. It was him, a guy in Bengali, and one other one that came through with him. If you ever want to hear a funny story, get Roberto Soto to tell you about the first time he went back to Puerto Rico, and they were going to have him as one of the invaders. Well, he didn't have a mask, so he knew somebody that made masks. The guy only he made them for mascaras. So he had a mask made just like Neil Mascaris, or Mascaris or whatever how you pronounce it, his mask, except without the M on it. And, of course, Mascaris came through and saw Roberto with that mask and told him he couldn't wear it.
Oh, and I can believe that.
You both know Roberto Soto. What do you think he told him?
There's no telling what he told him.
It can't be repeated on the radio. You're talking about Harley wouldn't speak to Mascaris. You know, that's the meanest white man I ever met in my life.
Don't think he wasn't.
And I would hate to have heat with him like that.
Harley told me that years back he had been to Mascaris' house in Mexico. He lives right outside of Mexico City somewhere there. He said, you know how Harley told us, he said, Daddy, he said he lives on a palace. Because he made all that money, you know, in the States and overseas. And,
oh, yeah.
And that's when stuff was dirt cheap. He said, Harley told me, he said, you wouldn't believe his house. You wouldn't believe it. He said, you wouldn't believe how he lives. And like Mike said, he made the movies down there. And then
I think he's still making movies. I think he's done one within the last 5 years.
I don't doubt
the plot. All those movies are about the same. They're always fighting some sort of alien or mummy or something.
Well, the first time I ever met him, Ernesto sent me to pick him up at the hotel at the Atlanta airport at the Ramada Inn, and it was 3:30 in the afternoon. And I asked Tom. I said, I've never met the guy. How am I going to know him? He said, well, you'll know him. I said, well, okay. So I got there in the park. I walk in. He's sitting in the lot. 3:30 in the afternoon. He's sitting in the lobby of the hotel with a mask on.
That's him.
I'll tell you how
he
surprised
protected.
Somebody didn't call the police.
I'm going to tell you how he protected what he did. I respect him for that. I mean, he was an arrogant, cocky joker, you know. And when we was in Japan, only in Tokyo, though, he wouldn't stay at the same hotel we did. Because he couldn't come and go, you know, because those kids would be out there with cameras all the time. and they put him in a different hotel. He really protected what he did. And I know one night we was on a bus, a small bus that picked us up to take us back to the hotel after we got through wrestling. And he was sitting back in the back in the dark. He took his mask off because it was hot. So that bus driver's looking in the mirror, right, rearview mirror. He sees mascara, so we come up to a red light. Bus stops, he puts in park, he jumps up, turns around, hits the camera, flash goes off, he takes a picture of mascara's. Mascara's put his mask on, goes up to the bus driver, takes his camera apart, and takes the film out.
Huh.
But he was something else. Made a lot of money.
The culture he was raised, because that was the way it was in Mexico. I mean, those guys, you know, Santo and Blue Demon, and when they died, they were buried in their mask. So they took this stuff seriously. I mean,
they took it serious, and I'm sure that Santos made a fortune down there. Did he ever come to the States?
He worked in Texas quite a bit.
He did.
I think that's that, and he may have done some stuff in Southern California.
But he's a legend, I know, down place. There.
Yeah. But he worked quite a bit in Texas.
He was an absolute legend.
And I didn't realize he started out as a heel. I always thought he was a babyface.
Do mascara?
No.
Santos?
Yeah. But this, when I was still living in Atlanta, they did. There was a Mexican group that was going around all over the country. In fact, they were using Ted Allen's ring because they did a show in the Gwinnett Civic Center in Duluth. And my daughter's school was paying for volunteering to you know, do things there during the show, and I worked the beer cart there. But I happened to see Ted and T.D. Hogan, who were carrying the ring around for this group and setting it up. So I walked down and helped them set the ring up and take it down. But they were still selling El Santo masks then. And, of course, Gwinnett County's got a large Latin population. And that actually drew quite a house there. There was probably 2,000 or 3,000 people there.
You're kidding me. And,
no, this was probably, let me think when this was. This had to have been 2002, 2003, somewhere in there.
Really?
They drew a good crowd, and my daughter was there too, because she was helping one of the snag bars. So I was on a little break, so I went and got her out. And I took her out. And we stood in one of the doorways, and we're watching their matches. Of course, their stuff was so high flying and doing that type of stuff. But the biggest heat, The Latins, they get into it. I mean, it's just like it was back in our day. I mean, they had true heels and they had true baby faces, and they got real heat and everything. But the biggest heat that I saw, or the most heat I saw, one of the heels, I don't remember, I didn't know who any of them were, but he did a thing where all he did was slide out of the ring and walk like he was getting to the dress room, and that crowd absolutely came unglued. And I told my daughter, I said, do you see the difference now between, and this was, like I said, almost 10 years ago. I said, you see how this crowd's reacting? I said, what'd that guy do? Nothing. He walked,
there you go.
He walked up the aisle. That's all he did. He didn't try and kill himself, and he didn't, you know, hit himself with a light bulb or jump through barbed wire and thumbtacks and all that stuff. You're talking about Japan. That's pretty much what's taken over there is all that, what they call garbage wrestling. Where they hit each other with light tubes and thumbtacks and set each other on fire and all that stuff. And, you know, if I'd have showed up at TBS studio one morning, Ole said, okay, you're going to go through a table and jump through some barbed wire and then we're going to set you on fire. I don't even think I'd have set my bag down.
I know, I wouldn't. I'd have been the only guy that ever went through a table, the leg would have gone through me.
Jeez.
Not me, brother.
With you working over in Japan, I guess that's kind of the opposite of what we've been talking about, Mike, because the Americans and everything that worked over there were the heels. Now, did you work any differently when you worked over there? Did you actually heal while you were over there?
Yeah, I thought I was. You know, it was a different pace. It was a faster pace. You know, but it was virtually the same. You know, they just worked harder than we did. I mean, they worked hard.
But the crowd was hard to get a crowd reaction from.
Yeah, yeah. The first time I went, you know, holy smoke, what? I know they don't know who I am the first time I ever went over there. And they oohed and awed. You know, ooh, you know, you do something good, you know. But they just enjoyed it, you know. And, I don't know how they draw now. I mean, in the day, it was like, oh, my gosh. Everywhere we went, sell out. And you know, they had their own stars, you know. Of course, I went for Bobber's group. And, you know, they had Jumbo, and, he'd gone to the Olympics. And
was that Saruta?
Yes.
Yeah. He got to meet him. Nice guy. He came into Georgia and stayed about a month.
There wasn't a nicer guy in the world.
Yeah.
Nicest. And I couldn't believe he passed away. I was just couldn't believe it. He was such a nice man. Just a great guy.
Another guy that came in here from over there that stayed here a while that was pretty good. It was a good guy. Was a Jinrico Tenryu. Am I saying it right?
Oh, Tenryu became a big star over there.
Yeah, good guy. He was very young when he was here.
He got big too. I don't mean fat. He got big. I mean, he was a star over there. Him and Jumbo and, of course, Baba, you know, was the big man. But I tell you what, they were great people to work for. They treated you first class. You stayed in first class hotels, travel first class. I mean, everything was, you know, just more than you could appreciate.
Baba brought his entourage to Atlanta. Barnett invited him over, and it was Baba and his wife. And, you know, Baba's, 7 foot tall, and his wife was about 3.5 foot tall. Kind of funny looking. But Saruta and Tenryu, and I don't know his real name.
I had Joe Iguchi with him, too.
Joe Iguchi. And I don't remember the guy that, I just went blank. The guy that blew the Kool-Aid. Kabuki. Kabuki, yeah, after the matches came up, he came up there. But Barnett threw a little post-match meal celebration for him there at the hotel next to the Omni in Atlanta. Got a chance to meet some of them and talk to them. Never met any nicer people in my life.
Well, you're not going to. They're not going to. And I just hate to see what's happened over there, that country, man. It's just Beyond belief.
Now, was Baba the only one you ever worked for?
No,
never
I went
worked
for
Inoki.
Never worked for Inoki. The first time I ever went, I went for a group that was called International.
Yeah, that was Ito's group.
Yeah, I went for them. I went for them the first time. But I never went for Inoki.
I had to work in there. It's kind of like I've heard people talk about working Indian reservations. The crowd they basically sit on their hands. No matter what you do, you can't get them to pop or do anything.
The weirdest thing I ever saw, since we're talking about Japan, we had a day off, and there was a place, a hotel where the American boys stayed for Inoki. It's called the Kiel Plaza. So I forgot who went with me. They had a great Hawaiian buffet, so we went over there to eat. And by that time, Butcher come in, Bill Eady come in. I don't know who else is with them. I'm standing there talking to Bill Eady, and I turn around, and there's a two-headed man sitting there. I don't mean he had two faces, but he had like a cranium coming out of one side of his head and had another, like, head coming off the other side, and his face was real distorted looking. I mean, like he was going to be two faces, like it was going to be a you know, twins or something that went awry. I couldn't believe what I was seeing. Most unbelievable thing.
You could have brought him back over to the States with him. We could have booked him.
Man, please. He's
still alive. He'd have booked him for...
Pepper would have made a fortune with him, man. Are you kidding me? Jack Pepper.
The Japanese double angel.
Yeah, yeah.
Oh.
Yeah. Pepper to come up with something. You know, he gave up. You know, Pepper gave a lot of guys their names, like Buddy Rogers, Valentine, Stasiak.
Yep. And he gave a lot of other people sound-alike names when those guys quit working for him, too. You know, Buddy Fuller worked for him as Cowboy George Valentine.
Is that right?
Ronnie Garvin was Bummy Rogers.
You're kidding me.
No. Rufus, they had several Hobo Brazils, one of them which was Rufus R. Jones.
Didn't know that.
And you guys both remember Isaac Rosario, Gypsy Joe Rosario, Pancho Valdez.
Yes.
He had him as Bruno Sam Narti.
No, he did not.
Yes, he did. He had Don Carson as Teddy Blassie. The list just goes on. You would not believe all the sound. And these guys didn't look anything other than Carson looked a little bit like Blassie. And I guess back then, Garvin could pass for a younger version of Buddy Rogers. But he had all those angels. You know, he had the original one with Morris Tillet, the French angel, and then Philip Olsson was the Swedish angel, and then Tor Johnson was a super Swedish angel. And then he had...
Where did he run? In Ohio or where?
He never really ran anywhere. He never had his own promotion. He always just... He would bring his people in to team up with somebody. He was there in New York for a while, and somehow or another he got the rights to where only his acts could run in Madison Square Garden. And then he had a following out with the Elder McMahon and Tooth Mont. And so he quit working for them, and that's why nobody could run the Madison Square Garden for several years, because Pfeffer had the contract with him, but of course he wasn't providing any talent. And he worked for Tony Santos in Boston. I think he had some tie-ins with Al Haft. He came down here in the 60s and was he was just basically managing people by that time. Yeah, he was down here. Probably one of the last things he ever did before he passed away is he came down here and spent a couple of weeks working for Lee. He was managing a girl called the Lady Blimp. She was a 400-pound woman wrestler. And, he had them all, man. The Lady Angel. Yeah, I think he's the one that gave Luma her name, if I'm not mistaken.
I don't doubt that.
But, speaking of French angels, Bobby, tell that story on Frank Morrell.
Which one?
The one where Ole fired him for something concerning a statement he made concerning the world champion. Do you remember that story?
That wasn't me. I wasn't around when that one happened.
I was thinking it was you that told the story. It may have been somebody else.
No, it wasn't me.
When Harley was the champion, Ole didn't like to bring the world champion in because it took money away from the rest of the boys, but he was bringing him in, so he, I don't know if he was in the dressing room thing with the TV studio or where they were, but Ole just told everybody, he said, look, Harley's coming in, so the paycheck's going to be a little bit lighter this week because he's making the rounds, and we got to pay him his 10%. And Frank Morrell said, well, by the looks of my paycheck, he's been here all month.
I like that.
He was to say, only fired him.
That's a good one.
He told me that story. maybe Charlie may have told me this story.
That wasn't nothing new to Frank, was it?
Well, that brings us to our name of the week, and hopefully this will be one you guys will remember and we'll reminisce a little bit about. You guys remember George McCreary?
Yes.
Yes, I do.
Wasn't around him much, but I remember him.
First time I met George McCreary was at Atlanta TV. We were working in the old TV station on West Peachtree Street, where we dressed in the lobby where they put the they put the boards up in front of the windows, and we dressed right there in the lobby. And Gary Hart was the assistant booker, and he brought George in, and we're sitting there in the dressing room, and here comes George in. Now George didn't look like much. He was, you know, not very tall, had a beard, didn't have a lot of hair on top. He comes in, and Gary says, "George, glad to have you here, buddy. Just make yourself at home." And George set his bag down on a coffee table, and he opened it up, and he started throwing stuff. He's throwing stuff up on the blinds and up on the lampshades, and he threw stuff in the floor, and he finally sat down, and he says, "Okay, I feel at home now."
He wasn't around long, was he?
He didn't stay here too long. The thing about, you know, it, looks are so deceiving. George McCreary in his weight class was the all-Army wrestling champion.
Yes, he was. He was a pistol.
Yes, sir. Yes, sir. He was a tough son of a gun. But you would never know it looking at him. But he was...
Did he go other places? I mean, that's his only place.
Yeah.
I ever knew he was.
He worked in Florida quite a bit. He came through here. Wasn't here very long, maybe a month. When Garvin and Bob Roop split off from Ron Fuller and started that opposition group in Knoxville, he worked for them up there. I think he wound up working after that one kind of died out. He ended up working some for the Poffos, and then that was it. Oh, and he worked for Einhorn's group when they were running. That was pretty much it. Never went anywhere outside the Southeast.
That was the only time I'd ever seen him was here in Georgia, and that was...
Never worked anything but prelim matches, and that goes to show you. I mean, here was a guy who was a legitimate, you know, wrestler and champion, but, you know, never worked anything other than prelims and was happy doing that, I guess.
Yeah, I never saw him work anything other than a first or second match. George McCreary, boy, that was, you yanked that one out, didn't you?
Yeah, that was deep. That was deep there, brother.
Oh,
where did he wind
run out of? You know, I don't know. I'm trying to think. He was from North Carolina originally, so I'm not sure. Whatever became of him after that, you know, after his wrestling career was over, because like I said, the last I remember ever hearing of him was in the early 80s working for Poffo. And after that, I have no clue.
That's, you know, I know you brought up McCreary, but that's another interesting character was Angelo Poffo. You know, I'm assuming Angelo made a lot. Well, you know, whatever dollar he did make, he died with it. He was, you know, he make Ted Allen like a big spender. But he, you know, just, I didn't meet him until very late in his career. But he must have, you know, he started what, in the 50s?
He started in 1949.
49, Chicago?
Yep.
Yeah, but it was just, he, you know, I'm sure he made a lot of money over the years, but he just, what a strange bird he was.
He was a stock market man, Bobby.
Yeah, yeah. But he just, he came in here.
Yeah,
you know,
he was somewhat famous before he even got in the wrestling business for setting that, or being on Ripley's, believe it or not, for doing 6,033 sit-ups.
Sit-ups, yeah.
For 4 or 6 hours, whatever how long it took him to do them.
Yeah. He was, you know, I met him. They brought him. He came in here, you know, Lanny Poffo came in here, Leap and Lanny, came in with Ann. And Lanny was only 19. This was the first place he had ever been. And he come in, and then shortly after that, they brought Randy in. Randy came in as the spider. And Randy probably didn't weigh 150 pounds soaking wet. I mean, he was a skinny little thing and very hyper. But Angelo showed up shortly thereafter and stayed here. I don't know, he was probably a year, maybe a year. I'm bad with dates and time frames, but he was here a good while. And, I refereed several of his matches, but he was, there again, he wasn't a big guy. Was not a big guy at all. He was short. But I don't know. Our business was so diverse back in the day.
Yeah.
You know, it didn't matter, it wasn't your size or your weight or, it was if you could get over or not. You had to have some talent.
Well, if you want to talk about a small man that, to me, I had the pleasure of wrestling him one time, and I was shocked. I mean, he was so good, and that was Greg Peterson.
Yes.
Oh, yeah.
I mean, God, I couldn't believe it.
And yeah, Greg was a pistol, too.
I didn't know that.
Oh, yeah.
Yes, sir. He was
Billy Wicks.
He was from St. Paul, Minnesota, originally. He and Billy Wicks came up together. They were boyhood friends, and they were YMCA or whatever it was champion. Both of them were shooters.
Didn't know that. But God, was he unbelievable? He was really just, I mean, I was impressed with him. And like Bobby was saying, the size, it didn't matter, I mean, he could just do whatever needed
or
to be done.
Or look at him. I mean, he looked like, somebody worked down,
he looked like a locksmith.
Boxes at a warehouse or something. He looked like a locksmith, which is what he turned out to be. But he was smooth as silk.
There's no doubt. He was excellent.
Tell you guys a quick story about the Poffos. They came in here early 1976. They were here maybe 4 or 5 weeks. They had put them in a program with the British Bulldogs, which was John Foley and his son-in-law, Ted Heath. Well, they were swapping the belts back and forth here, and at the time, the Poffos, Randy and Lanny, had the belts, and they were using Angelo as their manager. Well, they had decided, I don't know what brought it about, but they decided one night here in Mobile, Randy and Lanny had slipped some blackjacks in their trunks and were going to, I guess, try and take advantage of John Foley. And he was also a shooter. Well,
Big
it got going out there, and I can't remember who was. It may have been Jimmy McGuire, may have been the referee, but anyway, the match just ended up a big mess, and so the Poffos came back to the dressing room. Rip Tyler was booking at that time here, because Kelly had already retired. Kelly was working for Bruiser at that time up in Indianapolis, because he had moved back to Louisville. But anyway, Rip Tyler was the booker here, and they came back in the dressing room, and Rip said something to Randy. Randy smarted off to him, and he knocked him all the way across the dressing room, Rip did. Angelo went to go in his bag to pull out a gun when Eddie Sullivan was there. Eddie had already had his gun. They politely marched him right outside the building, and they were gone.
No kidding.
And, yep. Randy and Lanny deny this to this day that ever happened, but I know enough people that were there, because Rip and Eddie both told me the story, and I know enough other people that were in the dressing room that confirmed it, that happened. But I'm thinking to myself, well, Rip probably saved your life, because had John Foley known what you were trying to do.
Well, Foley, Foley taught Carl Gotch.
Yeah.
And Foley would tell you, he was not bashful. Foley would tell you, a teacher never teaches a pupil everything. I mean, he made no bones about it.
Yeah, Foley, he was supposed to have been one of the baddest ones to ever come out of Wiggins over there.
You know, Johnny Eagle came out of that school as well.
Yes, he did. Johnny was nobody to fool with. He's a dear friend of mine. One of the funniest guys I've ever been around.
Who never got his due. He should have worked on top more places than he did.
Yeah, he did. Johnny was, he was a, he was a unique guy. He was a fun guy to be around. I tell you another salty guy, Bobby, and he worked for you guys, was Ricky Hunter. I think we lost Bobby.
I don't know. I heard Debbie say something. I'm not sure. Could be.
Was you ever around him at all, Mike?
I was never around him. Saw him work, but I was never around him. But I've heard the same thing, that he was that way. I'm trying to think who else that came out of that school over there. I'm not sure if Jeff Ports went there or not. I don't know what his
reputation was.
I know Gordon Nelson. Of course, he didn't come out of this school. He was Canadian, but he was another one that was dangerous, from what I understand.
What happened to Gordy?
I want to say he's passed away, but I don't know for sure. Bill Bowman and I were talking about him the other day, I'm thinking he has passed away, but I'm not sure. I know he wound up out there in Amarillo, because you know he was married to Pancho Villa's daughter for a while, Aunt Marie Laverne.
But the last time I was around, he was in the Carolinas.
He and was in here in late 75 through mid 76. As the wrestling pro number two, he was kind of a takeoff on wrestling too. Because Baxter wasn't working all that much here. He'd work over in Dothan, but he wasn't working on this end very much. So they were using Gordon Nelson as the wrestling pro number two.
And how did he do?
He did real well. Did real well.
Did he?
Of course, he had some good guys to work with. I mean, his biggest, he was working with Curtis Smith. And Mike McManus, they were in here as the challengers, and he was working quite a bit with them, worked with Oki Shakina quite a bit. And so he had some guys, some good guys to work with. I've actually got a little bit of videotape on him in that gimmick. But I don't know where else he worked after here. They said that was in 76. I'm not sure if he went back out to Amarillo or not.
Because I was in the Carolinas in 78, where he went from there,
okay.
I don't know.
Was he doing the Mr. X gimmick there? Or is he?
Yes. Him and Jeff Ports.
Jeff Ports from Mr. X's.
Both of them, yeah. They were tag team up there. Rocky Smith was Curtis's brother, wasn't he?
Yes.
Yeah, he was his oldest brother. I think, what was it, 9 years difference, Bobby, something like that?
Something like that, yeah.
There was several years difference.
Rocky's son was at the reunion this year.
Really?
Looks just like Rocky. First time he come with Curtis, and it was
sure did.
First
Rocky
time
was the worker.
Yeah, I know we jumped over there on that little Foley story, but you may have here again. I may have told you, I don't know, but the deal, we were in Americas, and we had a guy on the front row mouthing, he'd whoop anybody on the card. He said, "I'll whoop anybody here tonight. He said, wrestlers ain't nothing. Whoop any of them." Dickie was promoting. And he come back in the dressing room, and it just so happened that everybody on the card that night could wrestle a little bit. And he told him, he said, "If y'all go out in the ring," he said, let me put this guy on the spot. He said, "He said he may come in the ring." He said, "If he does, he does." He said, "But, you know, you got to be willing." He said, "But if you'll come out here and get in the ring," he said, "I'll give you the program money that I made tonight. If he wrestles one of y'all." And he said, they was $30 in program money or something. Anyway, 6-7 guys get out there in the ring, and Foley is the smallest guy in the ring. And Foley gets behind the bigger guys like he's hiding. He's peeping around at the guy. And the guy got in the ring, and Dickie told him, he said, "You pick the one you want." He said, "You just pick out anyone you want." He said, "Let's see if you can beat him." He said, you've been mouthing all night long. He said, all these people have heard you. He said, now put up or shut up. And Foley's back there peeping around, hiding. Guy said, I'll take that little one back there. Got the most dangerous piece of dynamite in the ring.
Tasmanian devil.
Oh, man. Foley, you know, and to Foley's credit, you know, he could have hurt the guy bad. He took the guy down, and he made the guy give up by bending his fingers back. And then he let him up. Then he took him down, got the other arm, bent those fingers back, made him give up. And he let him up. He took him down, he got him in some kind of leg hole, made him give up. And then he took him down, got the other leg, made the guy, made him give up. And the guy finally said, I can't beat him. And he got out, he shook his hand, got out of the ring. And, you know, I mean, Foley could have hurt the guy bad, but he didn't.
Oh, he could have broken him in, too.
Oh, yeah. Yeah, I mean, it was just, you know, it was, I know the night that Jim Wilson and Thunderbolt threatened to break up Ann's show at the auditorium. And they come and bought a ticket and came down to ringside. They were sitting on about the third or fourth row at ringside.
Now, see, I've never heard this story.
And they were just sitting there like, you know, they had threatened to come down there and disrupt the show, to get up on the edge of the ring and make a speech and all this stuff. And Ernesto sent Foley down to sit at the timekeeper's table. All he did was go down there and sit. And needless to say, the show did not get broken up. Never made a move.
I cannot imagine what it would be like to be that dangerous.
Oh.
Do y'all know the story on Foley? On Gotch? Have I told that story on here?
I don't know.
No.
Johnny Eagles told me the story. Billy George ran that school over there. So,
yeah.
And Foley was the baddest guy there, no doubt. You know, he had that. His pot belly, buggy whip arms, most unassuming looking dangerous man you've ever seen.
He looked like a wino. He did, really.
So, Johnny says, Gotch shows up. Gotch, you know, his big amateur champion, European champion, beat everybody all over Europe. I mean, just annihilated everybody. So, here comes Carl Gotch, got that flat top, that V shape, the big, thick neck. He walks in and he tells Billy Joyce, he said, I come here to wrestle. He's, oh, yes, yes, yes. We've heard of you. We know who you are. Your reputation precedes you. And he says, sure, sure. So go and put your stuff on. So, okay. Gotch goes in and gets his stuff on, comes out. So Billy George calls Foley out. Gotch said, no. He said, I want the biggest guy you got here. George said, oh, no, that's not the way we do it. He said, you have to work with the smallest guy and work your way up. Said, okay. Get out there on the mats. Gotch takes him down, boom, just like that, boom. Lets him up, get back up, takes him down. Gotch said, I need somebody else. He said, no. He said, we just seeing what you got. Said, now we're going to wrestle. They said, the next thing you know, Gotch was screaming and hollering. and he told Billy Joyce, he said, okay. He said, I see what y'all do here now. And he said, I want to learn it. And there, and like Bobby said a while ago, then Foley evidently showed him just enough.
Mm-hmm.
But they said Gotch wasn't no joke, man. He wasn't
a
joke.
That's the way Gotch was when he took Hiro Matsuda $10,000. He showed him just enough, but it wasn't enough.
Just enough to get hurt, right?
Well, you know that's the thing when in our business when everybody wants to talk about the shooters, you know, Gotch is always the name that comes up. Very few people know who Foley was.
Yeah,
and,
exactly.
You know, I had the privilege to wrestle him one night over in Carrollton, and I was as afraid of him as if it was a loaded gun pointed at me. And he was as kind and gentle with me as anybody ever was.
The first time I ever worked with Thez.
Absolute pleasure.
Well, I only worked with Thez one time. I hadn't been in business long. I was scared to death. he was the world champion when I was born.
Yep.
And so they said, okay, you're on TV with Thez. And I'm like, oh, my gosh. And all the guys, the older guys, told me, they says, no, when he goes for that double wrist lock, they said, it ain't no joke. And it wasn't. I mean, but I respected him, you know, and I was like Bobby, you know. I was like, my gosh, why me, you know?
Yeah. You ever hear Briscoe tell the story about trying to go for the double wrist lock on Thez?
Uh-uh, never heard that one.
Rocket told me the story. They were in Savannah. Briscoe's working with Thez. Briscoe's the champion. They're sitting in the dressing room, and Briscoe says, well, He said, you know, I've heard about that double wrist lock all my life, him getting it on people. He said, I think I'm going to go for it on him tonight. He said, I just believe I'll do it. And Rocket then was agging him on. Yeah, believe you should. You ought to go for it. Show him who's the boss. You're the champion. You get out there and grab that thing. And they said when Briscoe came back to the dressing room, said he was skint from the tip of his nose to his forehead, where he had just been plowed up in that mat. He said, Rocket said he asked him, he said, well, Jack, how'd the double wrist lock go? He said, all Jack was said was, I missed it.
Well, guys, we are just about out of time, and before we run completely out, we've gone the full 2 hours tonight, unbelievably. I didn't even have Dickie Steinborn on with us. Just wanted to get a few plugs in for anybody who's coming into Atlanta for the big weekend this weekend. If you go to the Georgia Wrestling History site, on the front page they have a map of sorts that lists everything, all the events that's going on, both the WWE and the other events that are going on, their times, numbers where you can contact people if you need more information. And also, the other shows that are on our network, we had a double dose of Dave in Danger this week. They took over the Phoning It In show on Monday night, and they had Bob Orton Jr. on there. It was a very good show, so if you get a chance to go back and listen to that archive. Tuesday night they had Brody Lee, and then last night Rich and Les had Christopher Daniels on there, both of who are going to be in Atlanta this weekend for Ring of Honor. And I talked to Les while he was down here for the reunion. I'm going to try and get him on our show. But the problem with Les is he's so shy, I don't know if we'll ever get him to talk about it.
Yeah, he probably won't participate. I love me some Les Patrick.
Yep.
Oh, yeah, he's a great guy. And there's always a moral to his story. It takes him a while to get there, but there's always a moral to his story. You can do a lot worse than to listen to what Les Thatcher has to say.
Yes, you can.
Well, guys, that is it for this show tonight, and we will get together next Thursday. Hopefully Bobby will be rested up from his mini vacation, and we'll have to do anything else. And we will get together, and we'll do this again next week.
I enjoyed it tonight, guys.
Sounds good. Enjoyed it. Look forward to next week.
Take care, guys.
Good night, guys.
Bye-bye. Bye-bye.
We thank you for listening to this broadcast, a production brought to you by GeorgiaWrestlingHistory.com and the GWH Radio Network. Stay tuned to GWH for nostalgia, upcoming events, the latest news on pro wrestling and MMA, and more. GWH thanks you for your support.